Broadcasting through our flagship station, KNYE in Pahrump, Nevada, and worldwide on the internet. This is Midnight in the Desert. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you may be in this great, big, wonderful world. Happy Valentine's Day. Happy Palentine's Day. Thank you for making us your home for the best in anomalous talk radio. In just a few minutes, we're going to be joined by our guest. We'll be talking about deceptions, the truth about lies and deception. Rod Pyle will join us later on in the show as we discuss the new space age. You know, for those of you still single, you don't have to feel bad if you're celebrating this Valentine's Day alone. There's great news out there. Till death doesn't always mean till we part, I guess. A history of ghost marriages is a real story. Imagine a world where till death do us part wasn't taken literally, where you could actually be married after death and even get married after you'd already passed on. In actuality, there's no need to imagine necromancy or marriage that takes place after death is alive and well today. Through the form and frequency of the practice varies across the globe. The fact remains that in some places, the right to marry never ends, even beyond the grave. The most prominent still surviving legal acknowledgement of this is a French law, which dates back to December 31st of 1959. The law came following the collapse of the Malplaquet Dam, which left one woman's fiancé dead. Irene Jodart, the grieving bride-to-be, pleaded with the government to let her marry him anyway. It's unclear whether Jodart's social capital or the plentiful media coverage of her case swayed the French government, but within a month, Article 171 of the Civil Code was written. And it states that the President of the Republic may, for serious reasons, authorize the solemnization of marriage if one of the spouses died after the completion of official formalities, making it unequivocal consent. In this case, the effects of marriage dated back to the day preceding the death of the husband. However, this marriage does not entail any right of interstate succession for the benefit of the surviving spouse, and no matrimonial property is deemed to have existed between the spouses. In practice, this means that while a living person may marry someone who is dead, they cannot receive any of the deceased's money or belongings. They can, however, receive a pension and insurance claims. And any children born in utero at the time of the marriage are considered the deceased's legitimate child. Otherwise, it is a purely symbolic ceremony, as the living spouse is considered a widow at the time of the ceremony. Now, some 20 posthumous marriages are conducted every year in France, and there are examples of these practices also in the United States, South Korea, Germany, South Africa, Sudan, and Thailand. In China, however, ghost marriage was once permitted. The idea of marrying the dead takes on kind of a whole different angle. They have recorded instances of ghost marriages in China dating back to the Han Dynasty in 200 AD. The common arrangement was to marry two dead people represented by effigies, moving the woman from her original gravesite to her husband's. This would accomplish the joint task of giving an unmarried woman a place for her memorial tablet. It cannot be put with her birth family's tablets, as she is expected to wed and join her husband's family and their tablets, and giving the unmarried man's family a chance to adopt children in his name so he will have descendants to worship him as an ancestor. We have got a lot of really weird rules and regulations regarding death in this world. All right, I just thought I'd bring you a little bit of that sunshine on a Valentine's Day night. Now, I guess Michelle was scrambling, looking for a great guest to bring on. And what better way to examine love than the lies and the deception that lies beneath it? So joining us this evening on the show is Mark McLeish. He is a retired supervisory deputy United States Marshal, and he spent 9 years teaching interviewing techniques at Marshal Service Training Academy. And during his time, he developed the statement analysis techniques to detect deception in both verbal and written statements. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you for having me on, Dave.
I don't know what it says about our producer that this was her idea of a Valentine's show, but I'm all about learning about lies and deception, especially doing the show that we do and talking to the myriad of guests with strange claims and allegations. It would be great to get a little insight in how to tell if people are trying to deceive us, other than just being a wild story. I'm sure you've run into that. Sometimes you've seen some of the weirdest and wildest stories, and it turns out that they're really true.
Yeah, every once in a while it happens. Most of the time, though, if it's a pretty wild story, hard to believe, then that's usually what it ends up being, a deceptive or fictional statement.
Well, talk to me a little bit about this. I mean, there's been TV series about, you know, human lie detectors. There's all of this interest in lie detector tests, but it seems that those are even questionable in a court of law. Is detecting lies something that's even admissible at this point?
Well, as you mentioned, polygraphs are inadmissible in court, but they're a pretty good indicator if the person is being truthful or not. Most people determine if somebody's being truthful or not by looking at their body language and how they react to certain questions. And that, too, for the most part, is not admissible in court. Just because somebody, you know, touches their nose doesn't necessarily mean they're being deceptive. But what I teach is examining a person's language, how they phrase their statement. And because the techniques are based on the English language, namely word definitions and the rules of grammar, some of the techniques are admissible in legal proceedings.
How is that, you know, I mean, you always hear, oh, he declined a lie detector test, and they make such a big deal about it when most of the times those lie detector tests are inadmissible. Why is that such a big part of the story, or is that just great for prosecution to build off of?
Well, in an investigation, it's an indication. Sometimes they'll ask the subject if he's willing to take a lie detector test just to see what his reaction is. If he says no, then that raises their suspicion. Now, some people say, well, no, because those aren't admissible in court, which is true. But it can, you know, if you can pass the test, like if you have a missing spouse, they usually will always ask the other spouse to take a test. And if they take it and pass it, that usually clears them as a suspect. And so sometimes they'll ask the question just to see what their response is. They may have no intention of giving the test. And then sometimes you'll have people tell you, yeah, I'll take the test. And then a few days later when they're supposed to show up, well, they don't show up to take it. And that indicates, again, you know, possibly they're withholding some information.
Okay, so in your thoughts, I mean, do people... It's everybody lies, right? I mean, why do people lie? Why it's even in children that really you shouldn't have that knowledge of lying. They do it almost like a knee jerk reaction. And we carry it through. What is the basis for that? Why do we always feel that need to be deceptive?
Well, I think most people raise that lying is wrong. You know, perhaps a sin, you should always tell the truth. But as you mentioned, people will tell lies pretty much every day. Sometimes they're just what we call white lies. Maybe they lie so they don't embarrass themselves, or, you know, if their wife, you know, asks the husband, you know, how do I look today? And if he really thinks he's a little bit overweight, he's not going to say that. And he's going to say, you look perfect, or something to that effect. And so, you know, lying by omission is the most common form of lying. We tell people the truth, but we may not tell them the whole truth. We'll always withhold some information that, might be embarrassing to them, or, you know, might be incriminating to the person themselves that is answering the questions.
All right. Can you flesh that out a little bit more for me? I mean, if you know, how do the whole basis of a lie, is there specifics? You said that, you know, I know for a long time people were saying, you know, people that touch their face or their nose while they're telling a story are lying. And I'll tell you what, I've got an itchy face, man. I've got dry skin. So people start asking me questions and I'm always fighting to scratch because I'm afraid they're going to think I'm lying to them because it's been on Geraldo or Maury and all these other shows that any of those touches is a tell. And then if you're struggling not to do that, that's a tell. But what is the real, you know, kind of a breakdown of how lies begin and how you can start to see a deception as opposed to, you know, just assuming that they may be lying to you?
Well, the biggest thing is to listen to what people are saying. Too often we interpret, but we should never interpret because people mean exactly what they say. And the reason, by analyzing their language, we can determine if they're being truthful or deceptive is because there are several ways you can phrase a statement. And people will always word their statement based on all their knowledge. And so their statement may contain information they did not intend to share. But if you listen closely to see how they phrase their statement, then you can realize that they're qualifying their statement, or they haven't answered your specific question, or they skipped over something in their story. And that all points towards deception. And in an interview setting, that's going to give us some follow-up questions that we want to ask. So the biggest key is just to listen to how people phrase their statement, the type of words that they use.
All right. Can you give us a little bit of an example of that? If you were asking me, go ahead, ask me a question and I'll answer and tell me what, you know, I'm just going to go about my normal questioning as I would with you. But I'm just curious, what about it is the way it's being posed that would light it up for you?
Well, like years ago, you had the attack on figure skater Nancy Kerrigan, and there was speculation that rival skater Tonya Harding was perhaps involved, and she was keeping quiet about it. But when she finally came out and gave a statement to the press, she said, "I don't know for sure anything about what's going on at all." But notice she didn't say, "I don't know what's going on." She said, "I don't know for sure." And so the words "for sure" tell us that she's qualifying her statement. It tells us she knows something. She may not have all the details, but she knows something about it. But she was acting like she didn't know anything. And then I think it was like 10 days later, she did come out with some additional information. So a good reporter listening to her answer would have recognized she used the words "for sure" and would have asked her right then and there, "Well, tell me about the things you're not so sure of." And perhaps we got that information and didn't have to wait 10 days. And so it all gets down to listening. When President Bill Clinton testified in his Paula Jones hearing, he later on said that he was bound to be truthful, and I tried to be. Well, the word "tried" means you didn't do it. You attempted, but failed. And yet, that just goes in one ear and out the other, you know, when people are listening to him. But the word "tried" gets used a lot, and a person's trying to convince us they did something, but we know the word "tried" means, you know, they didn't do it. And so it just gets down to listening to how, you know, people, you know, phrase their statements.
Is that because people don't really want to lie, so they're giving themselves up a little bit? They're kind of giving an aspect of the truth?
In some cases, that's true. They don't want to lie. And so it is hard for a person to tell a direct lie. You know, "I didn't do it." And so they'll kind of soften that lie. "I would never do something like that. That's what you heard a lot from O.J. Simpson. I couldn't do that. I'm not capable of doing that." Instead of just coming out and denying it. So a lot of times it is they don't want to lie, so they kind of soften it up. But then other times they don't realize what they're doing. Again, the truth comes out because they do know what happened. So instead of saying, "I don't know what happened," they'll just say, "I'm not for sure what happened," or something like that.
Oh, really? Okay. So I'm not – but there's – you know, there are certain conversational cues that people pick up from each other in conversation. And, you know, hearing that, could it just be that somebody is used to giving that response because that's the kind of response they hear? So to them, that's a qualifying statement to say, you know, I have no clue. I would never do that. You know, it's because they're just, "Hey, I'm backing up my statement. I have no clue, but I would never do that." You know, how do you start telling the difference between somebody just being, you know, steadfast and honest and wanting to make sure that they're removing the guilt? Because I got to guess people that are in a situation of being questioned are going to feel nervous anyway, even if they're not guilty. There's nerves that are involved in that, you know, whether it's a crime, because you don't want to be. You don't want to come off looking guilty. You don't, you know, you're grieving over the loss of something or someone. So there's all of these different kind of aspects. That's got to make it really hard to peel through that onion.
We do have to take that in consideration. And that's why some people will use certain phrases like, you know, "I swear to God" or "honest to God, I didn't do it." Because maybe, as you mentioned, they just assume this investigator, this law enforcement official is not going to believe them. Maybe this person the subject has a criminal history. And so they feel like they got to use these extra words to convince this person that they are being truthful, because maybe they are. And so in situations like that, with certain keywords like that, I tell people, you know, you definitely pick up on it when people use phrases such as, you know, "I swear my mother's grave." It's an indication of deception, but it's not an absolute. It's, you know, I tell people it's 50-50, because some people have a habit of using it. We have to consider a person's vernacular. It may be part of that. Their language they grew up with, as you said. But in other cases, you know, people will use certain phrases that are telling us that they're being deceptive. Now, you'd mentioned like the phrase, you know, "I don't have a clue." When you hear phrases like that, such as "I have no idea," "I don't have a clue," that's an indication they are being deceptive, because rarely can a person honestly say, "I don't have a clue." Most people have an idea and opinion on just about everything. Now, some people will say that, and then the next sentence, they'll offer you a suggestion, because the truth is they did have an idea and they just wanted to throw that out there to give them a little time to think about their answer. Sometimes people will say that because they don't want to give an opinion. You know, so they'll just say, I don't have a clue. But the truth is they probably do have a clue. And so there are certain phrases such as that that you want to listen for that do indicate deception, because it's hard to believe a person doesn't have an opinion, an idea, you know, on just about everything in life.
Right. But if you're, you know, do you know who murdered someone? I don't have a clue. You know, in my case, I have no idea. But it's just using that terminology because we've heard it used over and over in television and, you know, in our own lives. To me, that wouldn't be an automatic sign of deception. It's interesting how that's looked at in different perspective. But again, then do you kind of find ways to rephrase the question and see if the answer comes out a different way? Is that kind of the other aspect of pushing to get to the truth?
We can rephrase the question. But with your example, I believe if somebody asked you, you know, do you know who killed her, you would say no. And then you may say, I don't have a clue or I have no idea. But as long as you say no first, you've answered the question, that's a good answer. So then you could maybe use those phrases that you have a habit of using. But, you know, I got to believe most people would answer that with a no if they don't know what happened or who committed the murder in that case. But yeah, sometimes we may ask, I mean, you're definitely going to ask follow-up questions if we think the person's being deceptive, and how they answer our follow-up questions can sometimes flush it out if that's just part of their language or they continue to give us, you know, deceptive answers.
On any given day, when you're talking to suspects, you know, and trying to get to the bottom of a situation, and you get these kind of hyper signals, you know, out of 10 people that you speak to that are giving you the, you know, initial designs of it being a deceptive answer, how many of them end up being truly deceptive and just, or, you know, just really confused and not sure of really what's going on at all?
Well, I teach people we're looking for several indications of deception. So just because there's one red flag doesn't mean, hey, you're lying to me.
Right.
You know, so what you'll find is that, yeah, sometimes a person's nervous, and so maybe they will give one or two signals and that's it. But if the rest of the statement seems okay, I would probably conclude they're being truthful, just a little bit nervous there. But what you'll find is with deceptive people, it'll pop up several different ways throughout their statement. And then once they start adding all these up, then it's a stronger indication they're being deceptive.
All right. And in most interrogations, I mean, some of these shows that we're watching now, they're showing some of these interrogations can go, you know, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 hours long. Is there a rule of thumb of what is usually the best time? You know, I mean, are you really going to get to the, you know, gist of it? Do you know it normally takes 6 hours to really kind of crack through the shell of somebody lying that you believe is guilty? Is that why they'll last so long?
In some cases, I mean, they'll have people just will insist they didn't do it, but yet all the indications are maybe the forensic evidence, as well as even their language indicates they did, you know, commit the act. And so then what you're looking for, you move from an interview more to an interrogation when you're talking several hours. And then what you're looking for is a confession. That's why it's taken so long. They're trying to get the person to confess. And of course, sometimes it's a matter of wearing them down. They may confess. We know also sometimes that leads to some false confessions if it's going on for numerous hours and you're wearing the person down. But that's usually reserved, like I said, once we know pretty certain this guy is withholding some information or probably committed the act itself, then that's what they're trying to do, is get a confession out of him.
Do you watch any of these programs like The Making of a Murderer, you know, that they have on Netflix, and kind of evaluate these stories and the video footage that you see of the depositions and the attempts to get a confession? Do you believe that in cases like that, they truly are being coerced, or what has been your take on it?
Well, I do watch a lot of, you know, non-fictional shows, such as you mentioned Making a Murderer, because I've always got my DVD going to record these, because a lot of times I get a lot of good examples to use in my training and the seminars I conduct. Either good questions and good answers, or, you know, good questions, but, you know, bad deceptive answers. Most of the time, you know, I mean, you see officers make mistakes. I mean, we all do. You never walk away from an interview thinking that was the perfect interview. You always think about something else I should have asked them. And so, yeah, a lot of times you'll see, I'll disagree with how maybe they'll handle the interview, the type of questions they ask or how they ask them. But the bottom line is to listen to how the subject, you know, responds to it. You know, with the Making a Murderer, you know, the show leaned towards Avery being perhaps framed, you know, by the police. But the one thing I saw with that when I was watching that show is that a couple of days after Teresa Halbach disappeared, a reporter interviewed Stephen Avery and asked Avery if Halbach had mentioned if she had any other appointments that day that maybe she went to after she was done, you know, talking to Stephen Avery and taking a picture of the minivan they're going to sell. And Avery told this reporter, I don't think so, because most of the time she takes a picture, then she writes down the serial number, then she comes and collects the money. And that's a truthful statement. But the key words he used was most of the time. See, he couldn't tell this reporter that she collected the money, took a picture, wrote down the serial number, and left. He just told her this is what she did most of the time, which is a truthful statement because she had been there several other times taking pictures of cars that they had sold through the auto trader. And so, again, you know, it's a big red flag because he couldn't say that she did all this and then left. He just said this is what she did most of the time. It's an indication that she never, you know, left those premises. And again, a good reporter would have picked up on exactly what he's saying and would ask him, you know, some follow-up questions to try to flush that out.
Do you have to look again in those cases? It doesn't appear that the Averys or his nephew, Brendan Dassey, are very well-educated people. And if you're realizing that that's what you're facing as well, does that add a whole new dynamic to understanding their version of the truth, you know, or their version of explaining a story? They might not be as eloquent in getting the point across.
In some cases it does. And we have to factor that in. As you mentioned, education level, if English isn't their first language, they don't have a command of the English language, then we'll have to factor that in. But that a lot of times that affects perhaps the pronouns that they use or the verb tenses. They may use the wrong verb tense because they have poor grammar skills. But there are other parts of the techniques that will still apply, you know, if they're uneducated. Did the person answer your specific question? Did the person answer a question with a question? All are all signs of that something's going on there.
Oh, really? So answering a question with a question is an automatic sign that they're trying to hide something. They're looking for you to make a flop so they can kind of jump on that.
Answering a question with a question means probably 99% of the time you ask a sensitive question. I mean, the one exception could be, could you please repeat the question? But even then, it's probably still a stall tactic. And what they're doing is trying to give themselves some time to think about how should I answer this question? And you want to realize what the person just did. And you should be asking yourself, well, why do you need to think about your answer? Why can't you just give me a straight answer, especially if it's we're asking yes and no type questions? But yeah, answering a question with a question always means it's a sensitive question and indicates it's the person stalling for time to think about their answer.
Right.
Happens a lot.
Yeah. The stalling tactic, you know, repeating the question back too. Is that just another stall to, you know, if you say, Dave, were you here on Friday night at 8 p.m.? Friday night at 8 p.m. Is that just when they're trying to do a stall technique at that point? They're just trying to come up with another way to answer that or giving themselves some time to move forward. How does, you know, or is that them maybe just looking for clarification on what you're, you know, this Friday or last Friday, you know, when they start breaking it down that way?
Yeah, it's possible looking for clarification, as you mentioned, if they're trying to break it down. But most of the time, again, it's a stall tactic because, again, it's usually they'll repeat the question. So essentially they're asking you the question back, but what happens is they don't wait for you to answer their question because again, it's just a stall tactic. They just say it, give them time to think about it. And the question is, why do you have to think about that? Maybe in the case of a friend asking you that, maybe he was doing something else and he's trying to think, you know, was I there or you know, whatever the question may be. But with an investigating a crime, they may be thinking, should I lie? Should I tell the truth? If I'm going to lie, how much of a lie should I tell? Or they may be thinking, well, they asked me if I did it, I didn't do it. So then they say no, but why'd they have to think about it? Well, it's an indication maybe they knew who did it. But there's a reason why they're stalling for time and having to think about their answer. And it's something we want to pick up on and then ask a few, some follow-up questions about.
All right, we're up against a break. We'll come back and cover a little bit more. Mark McLish, our guest. Again, if you have questions, you can give us a call at 480-571-3540 to be a part of the show. That's 480-571-3540. Our phone system seemed to be fighting getting the names, so I will try to call out the state that you're calling from and the three-digit area code. And if that's you, please respond. And we'll do our best to try to work that through. All right, stay tuned. We've got a lot more coming your way. This is Midnight in the Desert. We're back. This is Midnight in the Desert. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. The Truth About Lies and Deception. Mark McLish is our guest this evening for this hour. Mark, when you're doing this, what are some of, I mean, you've got to have some really funny stories that you've come across throughout the years of trying to break people and get the right information from them. What has stood out to you in some of these cases?
Not too many funny ones, but I mean, funny in the sense that you just know this person is lying through their teeth, that they're just telling you multiple lies about, you know, all kind of things, and it's just pretty obvious. And so in that sense, it gets a little bit, you know, hilarious, and that, you know, just tell me you did it, because they're just, you know, keep saying different things that, you know, are not true. They may make statements that are just very hard to believe. And that's probably one of the things that stands out. I mean, obviously some people are better liars than others, but you have some people that are just terrible liars, but they still just don't want to admit that, you know, my case, we're looking for fugitives. So that, you know, the boyfriend's hiding in the closet, but yet they're doing their best to try to act like they haven't seen him in 10 years, which is just, you know, hard to believe.
What are some of the physical attributes of a liar? I mean, you said that necessarily the touching the nose or things isn't a sign of lying. I know there's been talk of the way the eyes look up and roll to one side or the other means one side you're accessing memories, the other side you're accessing your imagination. Is there any truth behind that?
There does appear to be. When a person looks up and to their right, it's an indication they're accessing the creative part of their brain. They're making up the story. Look up and to the left, they're accessing their memory. So they're giving you a truthful statement. That does appear to be true if they're right-handed. If they're left-handed, it's just the opposite. And so that's one reason why, you know, I don't teach to look for that, because unless you've already established that the person's left-handed or right-handed, you could be, you know, misreading those signals. But one of the common ones is, you know, a little kid tells a lie. He might cup his hand over his mouth. He knows he wasn't supposed to say that. Well, as adults, we know not to do that. But it's almost instinctual, want to bring the hands to the face. So when people do touch their chin, rub their lips, indication is all it is. But what they just said may not be the complete truth. And so, you know, I do teach people to, you know, pick up on the obvious ones such as that. And then, you know, and ask a few more questions. When people cross their arms at one point in the interview, it's an indication perhaps they're closed off. Then again, they may just be getting tired of sitting there answering questions as well. But, you know, combined with leaning back in their chair, trying to get away with you. So there's some of the obvious ones you want to pick up on in any type of interview that perhaps the person's not being completely truthful. You know, in a social setting, what a lot of nonverbal people will teach is that, you know, if you're talking to somebody, engaging somebody of the opposite sex, maybe there's several, you know, people there, but you look down at their feet. And if their toes aren't pointed towards you, that means they're not interested in you. So right away, you can tell I need to move on to somebody else.
Well, people are screwed. I have duck feet. I stand. My feet are pointing in two different directions at all times. Nobody's going to ever get the feel that I'm into what they're actually saying. So those are some of the physical features of the lie. Do you see, you know, I mean, the movies make it always look great, right? You see the rolling sweat go down the brow as they're starting to tremble. And is it ever really that dramatic, or is it usually just the smaller ticks you're looking for?
Most of the time, it's not that dramatic, especially just in an interview setting, not really an interrogation. That's where you could maybe start to see a little bit more of that. But in an interview, just talking to somebody, ask them what happened, tell me what you did, tell me what you saw. Yeah, it's usually, as far as the nonverbal stuff, it's going to be the more, you know, more subtle things that they do. But again, some people start to get a little bit fidgety, start to, you know, shift from one foot to the other if they're standing there. And those are things you do want to pick up on, you know, why are they doing it? And again, it could just be nervous because of what had happened, or, you know, just the fact that they're being interviewed. And so, again, you want to combine it, not only the physical characteristics, but the language as well. How are they answering your questions? And between the two, you know, hopefully you can get to the truth.
What do you do when you're talking to somebody and you know they're being deceptive, but they're not giving up the information you need? I mean, how do you, is that when you play good cop, bad cop, have somebody else come in and ask the same series of questions in a different way? Or, you know, it's got to drive law enforcement insane to have to face these kind of people over and over again and not get to the meat of the question. Or is there usually a way to find that? I mean, obviously you're making a career out of it of helping people get to the truth.
Well, yeah, I mean, sometimes you may have to play good cop, bad cop, but a lot of times it's just, again, by recognizing what they said. When people use certain words like later on or afterwards, it means they skipped over something in their story. You know, they jumped from point A to point C, but they skipped over point B. So you recognize that. And then when they're done giving their statement, eventually I'm going to back them up to that point in their story and tell them to go on. You know, repeat this portion again, and usually they'll give you some additional information. If they don't, then I'll be even more specific with it. After you went to the store and got some beer, tell me what you did before you ended up at, you know, Bob's house, because I know they did something because he said, you know, later on we went to Bob's house. And so by asking these follow-up questions, you can kind of start to pinpoint it, and you're letting them know, I know you're being deceptive, I know you withhold information, and hopefully you're going to get the information from them. You know, we ask questions and people 99% of the time give us an answer, but you have to decide, did they answer your specific question? With like when Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma bomber, was asked, you know, have you ever built a bomb? He said, I never had my hand on one. Well, he gave the appearance that he is saying no, but he didn't say no. He just said, I never had my hand on one. Well, I didn't ask you if you ever had your hand on a bomb. I asked you if you ever made one. And so people will give answers, but they don't always answer the specific question, and they make it sound like they did. But if you listen closely, you realize, well, they haven't. And that absolutely means they're withholding information. So at some point, I'm going to ask the question again. I'm not even going to rephrase it. I'm going to ask it the exact same way. And if I have to, I'll point out, you haven't answered my question, specific question. And then again, you're hoping they're going to eventually give you a truthful answer.
Do you, when kind of breaking somebody down for this, I mean, does law enforcement have to lie in order to get, you know, to the truth on some of these cases as well? And how is that admissible in court, knowing that you were deceptive in order to get the truth from them? Does the ends justify the means?
Well, most of the time we try not to lie. We don't want to lie to them. Again, a good interview, good questions, hopefully you can get to the truth. There's nothing illegal about lying to somebody. In some cases, it may be, you know, that if there's two co-defendants, you interview them separately, obviously, and you may tell the one, the other guy's already confessed. He told us everything that happened. Maybe he hasn't. That's a lie, but now, you know, I want to hear what your version is. And so that may induce them then to go ahead and tell you what happened, you know, to give you a truthful statement. And so, you know, there may be times we'll do something like that. Most of the time we won't tell any type of egregious lies. Again, it's not illegal, but, you know, some people would frown on that. But again, if you told a lie like that and the guy go ahead and confesses, you know, again, that's all going to be, in most cases, admissible in court, his confession.
All right. We do have a caller that's coming in. I believe this is Daniel from Connecticut. Daniel, are you there?
Yes. Hello. Good evening, everybody.
Hello.
I want to ask the interviewer this. Like under certain circumstances right now, with what's going on with, I don't want to say President Trump, but, you know, around the people that work for him, right? That if they tell the FBI something and it's wrong, it's considered a felony. And a lot of cases where I know this, at least, you know, from television and so forth, A&E and Netflix and such, sometimes the police just go after a certain suspect and it's just easier to pin it on them than anybody else. Has that ever affected you when you had to interview people? Do you know what I mean? I'm sorry if I'm not clear.
Well, no, I'm not going to pin, you know, a crime on somebody who I don't think did it. I would never do that. But it's illegal, like with the FBI, like you mentioned, it's illegal to lie to them. And so that's what you'll see sometimes they're charged with. Now, you know, police officers have discretionary powers as well as, the district attorneys or U.S. attorneys. They don't have to charge certain people, even though they may be told a lie. And so sometimes that starts to get a little bit political. Should we charge this person but not this person? That does happen at times. But no, I don't think you'd ever have a federal agent that's going to pin a crime on somebody who they believe didn't do it. I've never seen that in my experience.
The Paradise Lost group, the Paradise Lost, are you familiar with that case about those three kids that were, I believe,
the
out
West
in
Memphis
Arkansas?
Three. Yeah, the West Memphis Three.
Yeah, they know that now the chances are they're innocent, but they don't seem to want to find out who killed those three kids. It seems like they're just complacent with pinning it on them and moving on.
Yeah, I think what happened there, as far as the end result was, because I was asked to analyze some of their statements, and I thought they were being truthful, the three of them, but is that the agreement was, I think they pled guilty, I think, to the charge in the end, and that then allowed them to be released for time served or something to that effect. So I think what law enforcement is going to say,
it was the Alford plea. They ended up having to cop to the Alford plea, which was basically saying that we understand we're guilty in your eyes and we'll accept that, but you know, you'll let us out for accepting that. And it's just a way that then the government, nobody has to pay them back for time spent for miscarriage of justice. The law is saying we have enough to go back at you in court again. So it's, you know, you're taking the risk, you know, but at that point they were playing with Damien Eccles' life, and Jason Baldwin, to his, credit, he did not want to take the Alford plea because he was innocent. And that was his statement, but he knew that this was Damien Eccles' last chance for freedom. So he copped the Alford plea along with, Jesse Miskelly and Damien Eccles. And that's what ended up getting them out. Now I will say this about that case. I've talked to a few people in the know, that are behind the scenes, that they're not done investigating that case, but they're done being high profile about investigating that case. They have somebody, actually two people, very much in their sights that they're investigating. I don't know if you know more about that than I do, Mark, but that's, you know, the last bit of information I got from them is they do have a few people that they are still investigating for that crime.
Yeah, I don't know. I have any specific information, but you're right. There's definitely one person they should be looking at, you know, for that crime. And I think that's, as you mentioned, they are doing it, but it's a little bit more low key. It hasn't got the attention as the original investigation did.
If you and I are talking about the same person, it got some traction in the last documentary, especially when one of the people tried to sue Natalie Maines from the Dixie Chicks, and that kind of broke some ground for them. They were able to cross-examine him in a deposition. And, you know, that's one of the people that I know that they're still keeping an eye on. And that's been pretty much out there in the open. But there's two people that I'm aware of that are still under a lot of scrutiny. And one of them has a pretty dark history around him. But I think they've been trying to nail him for some other deaths that have occurred around him as well. So in that case, I don't think they're really done, but I think they're going to be very cautious that they don't end up with another West Memphis 3 case on their hands. When they nail this guy, I think they're going to nail him probably for a totally different crime and not even try to attach it to West Memphis 3, but close it in their minds that they got their guy.
Right.
All right, Daniel. Yep. Thank you. Do you see that happening? I mean, you know, it is a point of frustration for most of us on the outside to see something like that go down. But you know, we know we can't get him for this crime, but we know he's committed others. So we're going to break him on one of those. That'll have to be how we settle this score.
Yeah. And that does happen every once in a while. I mean, you know, if they have the evidence and convict him of the first crime, they're going to do that, but they may lack that evidence. But then they have a stronger case with a second crime or a third crime the person has committed. So that's the one they go with. Kind of similar when a person maybe commits several murders throughout several different states, and they may try him just for, you know, in a couple states. And the fact he got the death penalty perhaps in Texas means if he committed a crime in Tennessee, maybe they won't take the time to go ahead and go through a trial and charge him with murder there as well. I mean, a lot of times that gets worked out with the families, what they want to do, But yeah, that does happen. Well, they suspect them of a more serious crime, but they can't feel like they have evidence to convict them of that, so they'll go with a lesser crime.
You know, I do a true crime program every Tuesday, and we talk to investigators, survivors, investigative reporters that have gone after some of these crimes. How disheartening is it for you? And I'm just curious, in the years you've done this, to know you've got your guy, but you just can't pin him down. I mean, does it ever make you just want to walk away because justice can't always be served?
Yeah, and that can be very frustrating. When you know you've got somebody out there who's committed a serious crime and they're still walking the streets. You know, my case, like I said, predominantly in the Marshal Service, we're looking for a fugitive. And when I first, came out with the Marshal Service, they gave my own fugitive cases, but they were all like 10 years old. These guys have been on the run for 10 years. Nobody could catch them. Here, you get to try. And so it does get a little bit frustrating from that aspect that this guy's still on the run. He's committed some serious crimes and needs to be locked up for. But, I need to find this guy. And fortunately, every case I was assigned to, some of them took several years, but eventually, we did catch the person. So that was always nice. But it took sometimes it took several years to catch this guy.
Yeah, it's got to be heartbreaking. I give law enforcement a lot of credit because I know, unfortunately, there's a spotlight shown on some bad police work. And those seem to rise to the forefront and attention a lot more than the good work that's being done by the police. That's why I do appreciate so many of the different investigation shows showing to just what length some of these investigators have gone to get their perpetrator. And that needs to be remembered. You're going to have a bad cop here and there, just like you're going to have a bad butcher, a bad baker, a bad candlestick maker. That's human nature when it comes to this. But dealing with the whole concept of the lies and how that goes down, I can't even fathom how frustrating that has to be for investigators to have to muck through, knowing that it's just tying up. And especially, do you often get people that come in and they're just deceptive about they're trying to take blame for something that they had no hand in? And how do you get them? I mean, you just kick them out the door, or do you have to go through just rigorous ways to evaluate the story and see if there's any truth? And maybe if he's not telling the truth, does he have enough knowledge to let you know that he might know who actually does hold the key to this crime?
Yeah, I haven't experienced that much of that, situations like that, but it does happen. People want to insert themselves into an investigation, even though they didn't witness it, weren't part of it. And it is frustrating for police because your investigators, you're wasting our time now. We have to track down these leads and the things you're telling us. But again, by listening to what the person is saying, you can get a feel for are they being truthful. By comparing, the known evidence with what this person is saying, does that match up? Maybe they're giving statements that conflict the forensic evidence, so it's an indication you're not being truthful with me. And so, but again, it takes up an investigator's time to do all that. And that's what's the frustrating part is.
Yeah, I can only guess. Why do you think people try to take credit for crimes they don't commit?
I think it just gets down to publicity. That's their, 15 minutes of fame, so to speak. And so every once in a while, you'll have people that will want to do that, or maybe some other unknown reason why they want to insert themselves into that story.
Michelle chimes in with a question about the Stephen Avery case. You said that you believe that some of the statements that he made were honest, but what about where it comes to his nephew, Brandon Dassey? In the way that he was broken down, and again, this is just to a layperson watching that footage, it looked like they were teaching him how to answer the questions. Did you see that as well? And, What do you think about those type of aspects of the case?
Well, he is a little bit harder to determine what his role was because of his low IQ. And you're right. I mean, they, he went through a lot of hard interviews there. Again, trying to break him down a little bit. But the key to me was, and I don't remember exactly what the questions and answers were, but it was when he was still on videotape and the detectives had left the room and he was sitting there with his mother, I believe it was, and she was asking him questions. And, I think he was giving her truthful answers. Now, again, it could be said, well, a lot of those answers were, put into his head by detectives and the way they asked their questions. But here you had a moment, he's just sitting there with his mom and he, pretty much confessed that he, was part of it, was there and saw his uncle, commit this murder. And so that showed me that I think he probably did have some culpability there, with her death. But he is a little bit harder to
analyze.
But
in his case, what he explained, there is absolutely no proof. I mean, there's no proof. There's the amount of violence that was attributed to that scene of what he saw. This girl was lashed to the bed frame. There was no wearing on the bed frame. There was no blood, and the amount of blood there should have been, I can't believe they couldn't have found some blood spatter somewhere that this guy couldn't, would have missed. They're not a very clean clan. That house is not a real, spectacle of cleanliness. So how do you miss that? If it obviously looks like the story that he's created is, didn't that seem false? I mean, just hearing the story sounded so outlandish, and then looking at the fact that there was no physical evidence to back it up.
No, I agree. That is one of the puzzling aspects of that case, is that we would expect there to be more blood at the crime scene based on what he was saying. I think also in the garage there where Avery allegedly shot her. And so, and with forensics, the way they are today, as we even see on television, a lot of it is true. No matter how much you clean it up, they can still determine if there was, a lot of blood there.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and so that is one of the pleasant aspects of that case, why there isn't more blood at the crime scene.
In all honesty, which is a good way to talk about this conversation, right? Do you ever get called in to be a contributor to examine this, and you say, "Yep, I think this guy's telling the truth," and they just dismiss you and they don't use you in the court? And if that's the case, isn't that kind of that's not giving the perpetrator their due either?
Well, I get investigators all the time that will send me statements and want me to analyze it. Usually they're written statements and want my opinion. Is the guy being truthful or deceptive? And if I think he's being deceptive, errors where I think they should ask additional questions. But in the courtroom, I've been asked several times about, testifying. But what I tell people, I usually talk my way out of it, because as I mentioned, most of the techniques are based on the English language. You don't need me in a courtroom to testify that when a person said, "Well, I tried to be truthful," that they weren't being truthful, because the word "tried" means they attempted and failed. You need me to be sitting at the table to point out what the witness is saying, but not necessarily to testify it. And I've seen it used in the courtroom by attorneys who are familiar with the techniques, or just are listening closely to what the witness is saying, and can point that out either to the witness, or I tell attorneys, you usually want to use it during closing arguments, especially if you're the prosecutor, you get to go last. When you point it out to the jury what the person has said, you can even read back the transcript if you wanted to, and because at that point, the defense can't rebut it in any way, because these are just closing arguments. And so it does get used in a courtroom from time to time, if we just listen to how a person phrases their answers.
All right. In the written form, and I know we only have about 2 minutes left, how much difference is the written form as opposed to the verbal version of a lie?
Well, I always like to get a written statement first if I can. Sometimes the situation doesn't present that, so we just go with the verbal interview. But if you can get a written statement, analyze it, and then go ahead and do the verbal interview. What you'll find, though, is that people sometimes will be more truthful in a written statement than they will in a verbal statement. Even though the verbal statement usually might be longer, because we can talk a lot more than write it down. People sometimes, even though they sit there thinking about it, just put them in a room, give them a piece of paper, write down what happened. A lot of times they'll be a little bit more truthful in a written statement and give you a little bit more information than they will in a verbal statement.
Interesting question from Vito. What do you do with a pathological liar, a person that just lies and lies and lies, contradicting themselves constantly, even in a single sentence? In 2 years, they've told over 9,000 lies. How do you know what to believe?
Well, yeah, in that case, I mean, one, usually it's pretty obvious they're lying when it's a pathological liar. Even if they believe their own lies, a lot of times they'll tell lies that are just so exaggerated that it's just hard to believe. So it's pretty easy to determine, hey, this person is lying to me. But then, like you mentioned, the trick is, well, then probably not everything they said is a lie. So it's a little bit harder to determine what is being truthful and where are they being deceptive. But we know from the get-go that they're being deceptive right off the bat. So we just take that everything they say to us, we have to take with a grain of salt.
All right. Well, thank you for the work you do and for trying to help to make law enforcement even more effective and get to the answers, because that's a big part of this. And I think that's, I would like to see in courts of law that justice is served, not who's right or wrong. Who does, I don't want it being winning, about right. winning. I want it to be about justice. And it's guys like you that are going to keep making investigators and attorneys better at their job that will make that happen. So I appreciate your work and thank you for serving and doing everything you've done for us.
Thank you for having me on the show, Dave.
It's been a pleasure. Mark McClish, our guest. You can find information about him on our website. Go check it out. Next up, Rod Pyle, The New Space Age. When we continue here on the best in Anomalous Talk Radio, I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Midnight in the Desert.